Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me again is Nari Ely, and we will explore the second episode of Ultraman, Shoot the Invader. Nari, how you doing?
Doing good. A few days of lockdown in D.C., but otherwise doing just fine. My liquor store is considered an essential business, so we're doing fine.
Yeah, it might be with the stress level that people have. So in California, the marijuana dispensaries were essential as well. So Yeah, it's a scary new world that we live in. And at least, for me, I miss barbershops. I really do miss the barber and look forward to them reopening. That said, let's talk about the second Ultraman episode ever. And it's one of those where they break the fourth wall. So we have him talking to the audience, explaining like, hey, how'd I get a black eye? So they were still figuring out the themes that they were going to have, because they don't always do that. Sometimes the narrator is speaking directly to both the audience and encouraging, Ultraman to fight on, get up, all that good stuff. And in this case, we have a race of aliens known as the Baltans. And they're frequently just called the alien Baltans. And they have abilities that include like mind control, speaking through people, illusion. And
it appears freezing people in time.
Yeah. And like, that's all bad. And so, the science patrol is on the case. And they end up having a discussion with this alien race. And they do have a meeting with all the joint chiefs that are there, and they're like, hey, maybe we should try talking to them, and everyone laughs at that.
Why? The immediate response is, this is no time for complacency.
Yeah, there are so many things wrong with that. It's like, here we are in this first contact situation with this alien race, and the immediate position is they're hostile, so let's kill them all. It's like, whoa. You don't know that. Why are you going with that plan out of the gate?
I just want to note that this is a great opportunity to tout the virtues of having a civilian control of the military.
Absolutely. So you don't just get into wars left and right or inadvertently commit war crimes, because
if you're a general and your tools are armed military forces, you might think most problems can be solved using your armed military forces.
Well, we have all these toys. What do you mean? We can't.
They seemed very eager to test their new missile.
Yeah, all of that was a little scary from just a concept of what are you trying to do here? That aside, we do have a dialogue that opens up, and it's an interesting exchange because we find out in this dialogue that the Baltans' homeworld was destroyed by a mad scientist conducting nuclear tests. So, okay, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a spaceship, and they escaped the destruction. That they have some enemy on Mars, or something bad on Mars.
Something that they really hate, yes.
And the word hate is used, so that's, again, could be a red flag. But the discussion is like, hey, you could live here if you follow all of Earth's laws and customs. So, like, again, the good guys do start from the position of being the good guys.
Although they do seem to immediately regret making that offer when it is revealed how many of the Baltans there are.
Yeah, and the reaction is like, well, that's just unreasonable. It's like, no, it's not. I mean, they're miniature. So if they stayed small, it's like, so we're going to give them an acre and we'll be good. If they're all going to, so here's the thing, we can't absorb you all at full size, but if we had this micro colony for you and a nice piece of real estate, could have everything that you need, but you're going to have to stay in your microscopic form. Cool. That's a win-win.
For anyone who hasn't seen the episode recently, the Baltans show up in a ship and there are 2.03 billion of them in all the size of bacteria, which is how they all fit on this little ship.
And the ship is a meter across. So it's something that one person can carry, because we do see that later, but that's its size and it's cloaked. So from a one perspective, you know, there's the issue of like, do they qualify as refugees? Because their homeworld's blown up and they're looking for a place to stay. And so we have this discussion, but when the Science Patrol gets a little testy with like, well, that's just unreasonable. We were so close. It's like, you guys wrote that off super fast.
Yeah. Like
and the Beltons weren't exactly being that open-minded either, because they end the conversation with, the conversation is over, we shall have the Earth. It's like, ooh, that's probably more unreasonable. And I will say, though,
that they admit to having difficulty with human language. It's possible it wasn't actually meant to be quite so ominous, but let's assume that that was accurate.
Yeah, it could be like, no, we're staying. It's like, this, we like it here. It's pretty, like, you know, we're going to go up on that mountaintop over there, and that's where we're going to hang out. Like, it could have been that. But so, like, I was very uncomfortable watching this episode going like, whoa, this is a big issue, because they literally can't go home.
Mm-hmm.
They can't go to Mars. We don't talk about any other planets or moons in our solar system. And things go bad quickly. So
the first question that maybe we should just explain a little bit is whether or not they actually fit legal definition of refugees. And it shouldn't surprise, I think, most people that this will fit your kind of common sense notion here. as you were just explaining, the operative part of their story here is primarily whether or not they are able or willing to return to their homeland. So if you'd like to go into a little bit more there, I believe what we're looking at is the UCCS protocol for refugees.
Yeah, and let's just take a read from it. And it states that all of those who are owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, member of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable or owing to such fear is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country, or who, not having a nationality and being outside the country of his formal habitual residence as a result of such events, is unable or unwilling to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to return to it. They can't return to it. It blowed up. Like, it's radioactive slag. It's worse than a Mad Max movie, so they can't go home.
Can I play devil's advocate?
Sure.
So the definition provided by the protocol on refugees does explain or does specify that it has to be fears of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership, of a particular social group or political opinion. In this case, your homeland being a nuclear wasteland appears to be indiscriminate reason not to go back. Do you think that this still qualifies?
I do, because why can't they go home? Well, their nation's gone. In this case, the planet's gone. And so what's your fear of persecution? Well, radiation poisoning, that's kind of high on the list. And the mad scientist who killed us all, maybe that guy's still alive. We don't know what happened to him. Maybe he wants to finish the job. So
right.
there aren't some, again, on some levels, there aren't some facts, but this is arguably because of a war that happened that has displaced them. So I do think the protocol would include them.
There is a semicolon which precedes the part of not having a nationality. So I'm inclined to agree with you that if for some reason, let's say even a country on Earth had some kind of catastrophic environmental disaster or a nuclear accident and literally nobody could live there, it would be difficult to imagine international lawyers seriously making and succeeding in the argument that they're not refugees.
Yeah, it's like, just go die. We literally don't care.
This is for political persecuted people only. Go away.
Yeah, just stop it. Just go. We don't want you here. I don't love you. Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons that could be in play. So, yeah.
And I want to add one thing, just because it's kind of an overarching theme that we're going to have to talk about in this episode and pretty much all the other episodes of Ultraman, since they all deal with aliens of some variety. I think we agree, just for purposes of laying some foundation here, that the fact that these entities are not human does not make them outside the ambit of the legal principles that we're discussing.
No, because, I mean, the law is written for those who don't live in your country. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily say human.
Right. They usually refer to people or persons. And it's, you know, we don't currently have a situation where we need to decide as a society whether or not sentient non-humans qualify, because we have yet to meet one. But I think undoubtedly we would include within the definition of persons sentient non-humans. We're getting close, actually, with some AIs, but anyway.
We'll get to that. So let's talk about, so things go south. Were the Baltans hostile to life on Earth? And you're quite skilled with the law of war. Now, does that, you know, discussion ending with "this conversation is over, we shall have the Earth," is that a declaration of war, or at least a declaration of hostilities against the people of Earth?
So, I mean, as I said before, I'm skeptical that they were, you know, actually intended to say that, but I'm just going to take it as given for purposes of our discussion, that that was actually what they intended to say. I think I would stop short of declaration of war, and this is a, I think, particularly useful time to be discussing this, as we have a current leader of the free world who likes to bandy about in hypercharged language with other nuclear powers who also like to use hyperbole in their language towards the United States. And, you know, threatening language from a member of the species who we don't even know is actually a leader or other kind of representative, let's assume he is usually not enough to say that we are therefore, you have declared war against us. You know, all bets are off. We're now going to war with you. So I would say, just based on that, no. I think, though, that the strongest argument for taking aggressive action against the Baltans, especially the Baltans on the ship, not just the one Baltan who was taking some hostile action outside, is the same kind of logic that surrounds preemptive strikes. It is, you know, I think my charitable interpretation of what was going on in this episode of Ultraman is that they reasonably feared that the 2.03 billion Baltans on the ship, who are all currently the size of bacteria, were all capable and perhaps about to return to their normal size, which would be, you know, Ultraman had a hard enough time feeding one regular-sized Baltan. It's presumable he and the world would be completely overwhelmed by the advanced technology and size-changing abilities of, you know, all of the Baltans combined. So that seems to be the most reasonable argument, is that although they may not have, those words alone may not have been aggressive, there was certainly reason to perhaps justify a preemptive strike, although we will get into that in just a second. I did want to say, though, that the one Baltan who was there, he did a lot of things that seemed pretty aggressive, like freezing an entire building full of people.
Yeah, and, you know, it gets down to the issue of, is the culture just so different that we don't have the same value system? And, like, we've dealt with that in a foreign policy perspective, dealing with, you know, determining rational thought of players. And listening to podcasts talking about, say, North Korea's nuclear weapons program, like, we would take something that only had like a 20% success rate and think, like, we would never use that. It's only 20% effective.
Mm-hmm.
But if their mentality is like, wow, it was 20% effective, you come at it from completely different perspectives, and that makes negotiations very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have completely different views of what's right and wrong. So with this completely alien species, non-humanoid, that they've lost their home, there's we don't know how long they've been in space. We don't know how long that they've been looking. So there's a bunch of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they admit we don't quite understand your language, which is why we're speaking through this guy.
Which is a whole other thing that we could get into. That seems like assault to me, but go ahead.
But if it was their only way to communicate, like maybe it's not. Like, and maybe that's normal for them, and like that's how other species have a first contact situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it might freak us out. And it's one thing of like if that person was like mutated or like not returned. Like,
or permanently harmed in some way, and it appears that he was not.
No. I mean, he probably wanted, you know, a shower and some, you know, a glass of wine afterwards. didn't want to talk about it ever again because it felt too weird. But, like, we could respect that. But this is an issue of, was this like, you know, the one fan from a sports team yelling crap at other people and then going like, well, I guess we're just going to have mob rule and kill all these folks. It's like, that would be bad. Like, that's, we don't make decisions based upon Frank being drunk, yelling obscenities, and thus we view all LA Dodgers fans as horrible human beings. Like, that's right. Not what we do, because that's like stereotyping, and it's just dangerous because it's just one person versus 2.03 billion.
And I also really like your take on it that you mentioned just a minute ago, that it's probably safe to assume that we're seeing the Baltans at their worst, not at their best. It's likely they've been traveling a long time. They're jam-packed on board this ship with their entire civilization. I believe it's all that's left of their race. So this is it. if they lose that one ship full of people, it's high stakes. So I can also understand the one Baltan who returns to full size, you know, being very cautious about letting any potential threats near the cloaked ship. And for what it's worth, I think, you know, the writers may have left some intentional ambiguity here, because the freezing in time, although it seems kind of aggressive, like we were just talking about, appears to have done no permanent harm.
Yeah, they weren't turned into a cube and crushed. Like, they weren't vaporized. There was no vampire cloud sucking the blood out of them. Like, so when you look at, ooh, what happened to the building full of people, it's like, they lost 3 hours. Again, not good. But it was an alien race that's completely different than us, that had been through hell, and they're trying to find their way in the universe. So again, it's that mix of, how do you balance that with, we shall have the Earth?
Yeah.
I mean, if they had landed in, say, the Sierra, and they, like, the desert, it's like, oh, cool, finally, this is home now, and then we would be a very different situation of, like, so a city that sprung up with some not humans living in it?
If they could have settled on Mars, but for the hated something that we don't know, couldn't they have settled on Antarctica? That's a pretty sizable continent with literally no humans living on it.
Yeah, or, you know, Europa or Io. I mean, like, there's...
I know, planets. Actually, why not any other planet? Venus has an atmosphere.
Yeah, and, well, yeah, landing on Venus would suck, at least for us and with the Soviet...
Right, but it would suck on Mars, too.
Yeah, it would suck less on Mars.
Okay, there's no sulfuric acid. That's a good point.
we can put something down on Mars and not, like, lose it in 10 minutes. So right. there's
But the moon, we could have been neighbors.
Yeah, it's like, could we build, like, a dome? Like, what could we do, guys, that so you could be happy and content and live your lives and not end up in a state of war with each other? Because things go south. And the shooting starts.
Right. And so getting to, I think this transitions well into our next topic, which is going to be, of course, the actual fate of the Baltans and our opinions and thoughts about the legality and then morality of those actions. So at the point at which the dialogue breaks down, you know, there's some fighting that takes place with the one Baltan who's normal sized. Yes. Ultraman, and his usual, colorful style, does battle with the one Bolton, defeats him, and reveals the cloaked ship with his, what was it called? His ray? His fluoroscope ray. There it is. His fluoroscope ray. And takes the Bolton ship off into the distance, and there is an explosion, and it is presumed, if not explicitly said, that they are all dead.
Yeah, I did a double take watching this for the first time of like, oh, sweet Jesus.
I thought at first, before I saw the explosion, I thought at first, oh, he's just taking them away from the Earth. They get the message. They'll go try settling somewhere else. But then there's the explosion.
Yeah, if he'd just gone into space and like threw them as like a disc. And
right,
like,
Superman style, toss them really far away.
Like, that's fine. It's like, okay, they're out of the solar system. It's like, we just, like, you just threw out the drunk dude at the bar.
Exactly.
In like, 1950s style, you know, bouncer. And, like, it's like, okay, we could live with that. Not the case. Takes them out and blows them up. 2.03 billion of them. And that's where I had this, oh my God, this is a children's show.
What message, I know!
What message was just sent to children of Japan in the 60s? I mean, it's like, I think it's genocide. Because one, if it was all of, it doesn't have to be all of them. And you might not remember this because you would have been young and I was in college when this happened, but in the election of 1996 during the Republican primary, and or was this 2000? Anyway, it was with somebody named Alan Keyes, who has always been kind of a jerk. And they were talking about the Balkans and people being killed in the Balkans and, you know, what Milosevic was doing. And Keyes made some comments like, well, like, how many does it have to be to its genocide? It's like, there's some still left. And it's like, dude, you're a pig. Like, you don't, it's like, do you want it to be complete in order to say, like, yep, it was genocide, they got them all? Or are a few left? So, whatever
also,
it is.
Also, I'm having a hard time thinking of, so there are a number of, well, you know, commonly accepted genocides that took place in the last century. I believe none of them were quote-unquote successful. There are still Jewish people. There are still Tutsis and Hutus, both in Rwanda. But the, you know, the fact that they didn't get them all doesn't mean it's not a genocide. But in this case, I think he got them all.
Yeah, and that's why, like, we laugh in horror, because, like, yes, it's tough to process it. It's like people
would be... It's only funny because it's on a children's show. What is going on?
Yeah, it's like the people who deny, and this happened in the state of California, when California in the late 90s was debating about having a resolution about the Armenian genocide, and it was proposed by, I believe, Howard Kaloukian, and I interned for him when I was in law school.
Oh!
And it was like one of the Democrats, like, we don't even know if this really happened, as people did spit takes, you know, across, you know, the great state of California, going like, what do you mean, like, you don't believe the Armenian genocide happened?
Yeah,
just because the photos are black and white, that's, you don't, it wasn't close enough to your lifetime, or all the witnesses are dead because time works that way.
Mm-hmm.
That aside, this was one spaceship, like a meter across, that had over 2 billion Baltons in it, and Ultraman blows it up. Now, the...
Yeah! So, okay, so let's just read off really quick the definition of genocide, just so listeners or viewers know exactly what we're talking about here. So the crime of genocide, as defined by United States Code, is when someone, quote, whether in time of peace or in time of war, and with the specific intent to destroy, in whole or in substantial part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such, kills members of that group. And that's 18 U.S.C. section 1091, subsections A1.
I think that's also from an international treaty, but I would need to double check which one. But I think it's codified, but I would need to verify that. So that's all bad, because the way the law's written, you don't have to get them all. It's like, well, you can only attempt genocide, because you have to really be successful at wiping out the women and children and salting the field so life never grows again to be sure that they're not coming back. That's a high standard.
Right. And I think also the distinction here, in which it's, this definition does not include small numbers. And I think that matters, because that would be a hate crime, but it wouldn't be a genocide, right? So if somebody goes on a hate crime rampage and kills a couple people, that's terrible. And it is being a hate crime is a aggravator in federal law, and you're going to get much worse sentence for it. But I agree with the idea that genocide is usually considered some kind of meaningful attempt to exterminate people on the basis of these identity groups. And in this case, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to see how this doesn't fit the definition, especially because it, as far as we know, is actually in whole, and it was complete, and it was quote-unquote successful. here's a question. I think under this definition, Ultraman is clearly on the hook for the punishments. Which, what are the punishments for genocide in U.S. code?
Well, nothing that I would want to have to deal with, but it's either death or imprisonment for life and a fine of not more than $1 million or both. So, we really go big on this one, because it's a serious crime. We don't want people trying to go wipe out a racial group.
I know. I actually feel like we should maybe revisit that not more than $1 million, just because I think we could go higher. But I think in the events of this episode, Ultraman is on the hook. Do we think anyone else might be on the hook?
There could be an interesting issue with the science patrol and respondent superior type issues, because while Ultraman is not directly in the science patrol, because they don't know Hayata is Ultraman, even though I'm pretty sure that they all do know, but they're just kind of letting it slide so he can feel normal. But that being said, if you can show like the causal relationship that Ultraman is an actor of the science patrol, and thus,
which is also an actor of the Japanese government, I believe,
and through international treaty, their headquarters is in Paris. So, like, you could have that organization and possibly the government of Japan on the hook. So that could be interesting. Or you could say, like, well, Ultraman's an alien from the Land of Light who's here for justice and commits genocide in the second episode. And was Hayata, like, driving? Like, was he in control, or is Ultraman separate?
And so I haven't seen every episode of Ultraman yet. It seems to me that he is, right? What do you think?
It's a little tough to tell, because is it like Thor and, Donald Blake type, relationship where they're actually two different people? Or is it more like Superman Clark Kent?
Right.
And it might be more like Thor and Dr. Blake.
So it might be just Ultraman, which would also raise some complicating issues about jurisdiction, since he is an alien, not a citizen.
Yeah.
And I mean that in the literal sense, not as in the illegal immigrant sense.
No, he's not from around here. Really. This is his home now. And
when people ask him, where is he from, they really mean, where the heck are you from?
So you're all silver, and I like the red Speedo thing.
And like fins, yeah.
I mean, it looks cool, and I know the suit actors loved it, because it's like, if you're dressed as Godzilla for, an extended period of time, that outfit would be way easier to wear. So there's all that. But I think part of this stems, you know, to the World War II experience, where we didn't do enough war crimes with the Japanese government, that we didn't put Hirohito on trial for the 25 million Chinese people that Japan killed, mostly with swords. But if you read, what was it, Flyboys, that got into the rape of China, truly was atrocious. So the Japanese military tested microwave weapons on Chinese prisoners, made sons rape mothers, truly evil, disgusting. You throw up when you read everything, and they weren't held accountable for that. And which is why China gets really upset whenever a Japanese prime minister says nice things about Japanese soldiers. And, you know, it also skews the fact that in a lot of the kaiju movies, Japan, you know, plays the victim card from, you know, the two atomic bomb attacks. It's like, you really want to go there? Let's talk about the Bataan Death March. Let's talk about what happened in China. Let's talk about every other theater where you butchered human beings, and you're all kind of taking the forget-me pill on that one.
So this does bring up the related topic. So I think we're on the same page here that this definitely fits the bill for genocide. It brings up the related topic about whether or not Ultraman blowing up the ship full of 2.03 billion Baltans violated the laws of war. And I think that there is an interesting parallel, although I actually think we might be in more agreement about this than I thought based on what you just said, but let's get into it. So it raises the interesting parallel, I think, of 1945 Japan, right before the end of the war. You know, again, I think the most reasonable justification for why Ultraman did what he did is, you know, assuming not because he has a deep racial hatred of the Baltans, but because, you know, he reasonably feared that, you know, each one of those 2.03 billion Baltans could quickly and soon would return to ordinary size, at which point he would no longer be able to protect the Earth, because he had to go to town just to protect Earth against one. The issue, of course, is that they were not at that time combatants. They were not engaged in aggressive conduct. They were not engaged in hostilities. That's one of the most important distinctions when it comes to the law of war, is combatants versus non-combatants. And we've talked about this topic in other panels and podcasts and stuff, but it's why the issue of terrorism and non-uniformed combatants is so difficult, because this is so core and central to the laws of war. But in this case, I think that there's no serious complicating factors, although actually maybe they were all uniformed soldiers in their ship in their microscopic form, but who knows? Let's assume that they're not. You know, the argument that we fear that these non-combatants are about to become combatants, I think that there's a serious problem with that, because, you know, in almost any circumstance, people can reasonably argue that we fear that these non-combatants are going to become combatants. And because it's such a core distinction, I am very wary, and I think the law of war is very wary, of any arguments or reasoning which tries to blur that line. And in the case of, for example, 1945 US versus Japan, there are multiple arguments for why the United States dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. I believe one of the most prevalent ones is that there's a couple. The one that's most relevant here is the argument that the Japanese government was training its civilians, its including its women and children, to fight should the Americans actually land. So there was a reasonable fear that the entire civilian population of Japan was going to all become, or mostly become, combatants, and that it would cost a lot of American lives to actually take Japan by force. Second argument, they were refusing to surrender even when it looked like they were pretty well and defeated. There's problems with that, because they were actually refusing an unconditional surrender, and it turns out that the conditions we did demand of them were things that they were probably willing to do anyway. that we were willing to concede anyway, which was to keep the Emperor of Japan. And we did actually do that in the Peace Treaty. So there's also an argument related to trying to show the Soviet Union that we had the atomic bomb and what it could do, but I find that the least appealing of all of these arguments. So I'm going to stick with the first one, which is that we reasonably believed or had reason to fear that the population, civilian population of Japan was going to rise up and be combatants. And that seems to be the most close parallel here to the Ultraman episode. Maybe this is also why they cover it in this episode, who knows? But anyway, I think in this specific instance, taking just this that act in isolation, it seems to me to be a pretty clear violation of the law of war. But I will say, Josh, that I hadn't thought about what you just discussed just now, which is that law of war, another fundamental principle is that it's based on reciprocity. The assumption, a fundamental assumption of law of war is both sides think they're in a just war. So you can't make distinctions between, oh, well, you can do this if your war is just, and you can't do this if your war isn't just. It's instead premised on reciprocity. What do you want your enemy to do to your soldiers when you capture them? What do you want your enemy to do when it comes to treating your civilian populations? And if you don't want your enemy to bomb your civilian populations, you don't bomb theirs. If you don't want your enemy to rape your civilian populations or do unspeakable things to them, you don't do it to them. And the Japanese were known in many instances, including to the Americans, to do some pretty unspeakable things. There was only, I believe, one, or I think there's only been one, maybe a few, but certainly one of only a few instances of prosecutions for war crimes involving cannibalism of POWs was Japanese soldiers cannibalizing American POWs.
On Chichijima, which is the five guys who got shot down there, four were eaten. The fifth landed in the water in his little life raft. A submarine picked him up. He went and married his sweetheart, Barbara, and in time, fathered a bunch of kids and was ambassador to China, then vice president, and then president of the United States, and then he had a kid who became president. So, and
HW for anyone who hasn't figured it out.
And if you, again, highly recommend the book Flyboys that talks about this, because it's beautiful. It highlights that not everyone on that island was on board with it, and that the one of the guards befriended the last flyer that got eaten, and he was not happy about his friend getting eaten. And after the war, he changed his name to carry his fallen friend's name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a damn beautiful story. And if you know what HW went through in reading about that mission, you can't help but love the man even more. That aside, you know, the Baltans don't show anything like a Iwo Jima, an Okinawa. You know, they're not torturing POWs. They're not building the death railroad. They're not doing all those things. They show up and just ask for a home, and the communications are at best botched, and or there's a fundamental lack of it, because we have two species that don't know how to talk to each other.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, perhaps the strongest argument for why the United States did not break the law of war in 1945 was because reciprocity had already been shot to hell. Okay. But I still think, and this is kind of how I feel about the Ultraman episode also, I still think that you hold yourself to your ideals. And just because your enemy has gotten to this particular low doesn't mean that you do as well. I'm personally of the opinion that dropping the A-bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima was a violation of the laws of war. I'm not entirely sure on the question of, was it definitely the wrong thing to do? Because those are actually two different things, and we get into that as lawyers a lot. There's a difference between something being illegal and something being, taking everything into account, clearly the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I have no problem with in either camp that we did the right thing because we ended the war that we were not wanting to get into thanks to a surprise attack by the Empire of Japan. And after nearly 5 years of bloodshed and brutal, ugly bloodshed. My grandfather was on the USS Boxer, the lead ship in the invasion of Japan. And everyone on that ship, from his stories, because he's 98, they thought they were going to die defeating the Empire of Japan. And U.S. war planners thought the war was going to go into the 1950s, in large part because of the experience on Okinawa. So, I mean, that was brutal, it was ugly, and we had the ability to end it, and we did. Because if we had had those super weapons and not used them, Truman's head would have been on a pike. Because it's like, oh, how many people died? And we had to exterminate the country of Japan in the same process? Thanks. No, we did the right call. And, you know, there's this maxim, if you're going to have to fight a war, you fight to win. And that's exactly what we did after they started it. That aside, we're really good at making peace. And my grandfather went to Japan 3 times. First time was, you know, right after the surrender had been signed. Mm-hmm. And going downtown and everyone being really freaked out, but they were all treated very well. The other times were he hosted 2 Japanese exchange students.
Oh.
Yeah. Developed a great love for Japan and its people, and like went to go visit their families 2 times and tour about because he fell in love with the country. And that's something that's very American, that we will fight to the death and then make a country our friend.
Right. Certainly the certainly in the last century, that's definitely been the American tradition. But actually, no, I think going back to Great Britain, no, this is that's the history of our country.
We're the great barbecue. It's just, you know, America's the only place where you can have a barbecue when we're not socially distancing. You know, that could literally have pizza, Chinese food, Japanese food, street tacos, and curry all at the same time. And that's the beauty of America, that we all live here. And, you know, again, Nikita Khrushchev's son is an American citizen. And again, like we should have just been dropping lawn chairs and barbecues on those guys because they went away like, what? We could have a burger? Tell me more. You know, what's this ketchup of which you speak?
Oh, I just got to tell you, Josh, there's a show, I think it's on, it might be available on Amazon Prime, but you got to watch it because it's hilarious. And it's Comrade Detective.
Okay.
It pretends to be archival footage or an actual old show from a former Soviet nation from their Soviet times. Of course it's not, it's made recently. But basically, right, so it's kind of a parody of all of this of all of the Soviet stuff. And the big contraband that this detective is looking for is Jordache jeans. Extremely valuable black market goods.
yes.
So yeah, just, yeah.
I will check that out while we're all socially distancing.
Exactly. There's no shortage of good things to stream, though, so I won't take it personally if you don't get to it right away.
I will do my best.
But I wanted to ask, was your grandfather's experience with Japan and Japanese culture the origins of your long-standing love affair with Japanese culture and anime and, of course, Ultraman?
Not directly. I mean, I was in kindergarten when they had the exchange student, maybe the first grade. Mm-hmm. And she was super sweet. She was just a delightful woman. And she actually visited my grandfather like 2 months ago.
So oh, wow. She
came over from Japan to.
And before Corona, so that was good.
Before the unpleasantness.
Yes.
So, and I don't remember the first exchange student because I was too young for that. But they've maintained letter writing, emails, and all that good stuff for decades now. I do fondly remember watching Star Blazers as a little kid, and because it premiered on my birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I guess it was 4. So, like, there's all of that. But you know, there's a certain international language of seeing, you know, a giant monster fight a giant robot that kids just gravitate towards. It's like, well, tell me more.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And that's the, I think that was part of the connection. But no, the experience for my grandfather is like, we have to live going forward because we can't keep refighting the mm-hmm. battles of the past. And, you know, going to college in the 90s, there was a lot of revisionist history at that point in time of like, oh, we could have just invited the Japanese people over to Nevada when we tested, you know, the atomic bomb. It's like, no, like that's delusional thinking. And, you know, Japan wanted to keep fighting. You know, there was an attempted coup to overthrow the emperor after the two atomic bombs, so they would fight to the last man. And mm-hmm. it took one of the top generals, you know, committing suicide and them releasing the recorded statement by the emperor announcing the surrender. So, you know, yeah, there were the hawks that brought the war and nearly drove them into oblivion. There's a great book called The Pacific Crusade that mm-hmm. talks about the origins of World War II, that it basically goes back to the 1890s. And, you know, in talking about, you know, whether it was racism in mm-hmm. San Francisco, with, you know, again, it starts with the Chinese Exclusion Act, but, you know, they kind of lumped in anyone from Asia and treating people horribly. And both sides viewed each other as the superior. And so, like, you get that level of ego. And it was decades in the making mm-hmm. of the way the militants took control of the Shinto belief system and militarized it. That was all bad, all bad. Yeah. So yeah, it's amazing how wars happen, but knowing, you know, like this wasn't just some magical thing that just started overnight.
Oh, right.
You know, it was years in the making.
But to bring it back to Ultraman, this was something that started overnight.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also don't want to second guess history too much. So setting aside whether or not we think that dropping the A-bombs in Japan was the right thing or the legal thing to do, I think we both agree that it's a little easier to make that call with Ultraman. And I, at least in my view, it seems yep. pretty clearly to yeah. violate the laws of war. There was, as you know,
on
as
a
far
children's
as I can tell,
show.
Yeah. There was no actual reason to think that all 2.03 billion were suddenly overnight going to become combatants. And again, the only hostile actions that were taken by the one Bolton that was running around causing mischief was best characterized as mischief. He was freezing people and doing no permanent harm. So you also don't have an argument that, you know, reciprocity didn't apply here. He doesn't seem to be doing anything that is egregious in the way that World War II Japan was, or pre-World War II, Imperial Japan, let's just go with that. and so in this case, it's very difficult for me to see how this was not a war crime.
It's bad. I mean, you can't envision the entire population on that ship as being hostile. Because they're it's like, are you saying that they're all soldiers?
It's like, are there no children?
No family. So you guys are going to have a really hard time, you know, procreating if like the only, if it was a single gender military and all the women were dead. And there are no kids. It's like, you guys are literally the last of your kind.
It would also change the analysis of letting 2.03 billion settle if, well, that's it, then they're all gone.
They're going to die out eventually. So as long as they don't have like some hyper long lifespan.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, we live 1,000 years. It's like, oh, didn't want to hear that part. Ah, damn. So we're going to be like a family dog to you. Okay.
But yeah, it's very difficult to imagine that all of the inhabitants of that ship were combatants. And it's also difficult to understand why, because we know so little about what's in that ship. We never see the inside of the ship. No one ever scans it. You know, maybe Ultraman can secretly see inside it, but he certainly never reveals it. We don't know what they're basing this assumption on, that those are all soldiers on that ship. So I think it's safe to assume the opposite, that there were definitely non-combatants on that ship, if not all non-combatants on that ship. And therefore, it's very difficult to see how that, you know, colors between the lines of the laws of war.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing to see the hero wipe out 2 billion life forms in the second episode, and then the comical discussion about, like, him not being able to sleep and how he has a black eye.
Yes, because that's what we're all wondering about now, is this guy's black eye.
It's like, how are you sleeping at night?
Shouldn't it be the opposite, that he starts out sleeping soundly and then now is having a difficult time falling asleep?
No, I have nightmares. I hear their screams whenever I close my eyes. It's like, dude, how did that sneak by the storytelling group? Because
I have to assume that it was intentional, that it's supposed to make the adults go, what just happened? And their kids are completely oblivious and confused as to why their parents are freaking out.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, compare this to the Star Trek episode Balance of Terror. You know, we have the cat and mouse game, and at the end, Kirk, offers a refuge to the Romulan commander, like, you don't have to die, we'll beam your crew over, trying to take the high road of, you don't have to die today. And in the commander, like, we could have been friends. It's like, okay, this is all sad, and it's, represents the professional military rather well compared to, and again, for a children's,
I could come up with a million examples from Star Trek. Janeway doesn't want to kill Borg, even Borg drones, if she doesn't have to.
Yeah, it's just because they're victims. This completely ignores all of that. And that's why it's so mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And the fact that they do acknowledge it, like, because there is a discussion, and then it all goes south really fast. Very mixed feelings on that.
Yeah. I personally hope, I think and hope, it was intentional and it was supposed to make the adult audience wonder, what just happened here and think about it.
Most likely. And the rest of the I've seen a bunch of episodes now, and I enjoy it a lot, and there's a lot to discuss. There are some, I watched one last night that was like on the fourth disc.
Mm-hmm.
That shows like some different directorial choices, and like,
ooh.
And it's like, okay, so they got into some borderline experimental filmmaking with, like, let's have them by the campfire and a light behind the characters while they're talking, so they're silhouetted, and it's just like, wow, okay, somebody went to, a film school and was experimenting with one of the episodes, so
now's my chance.
Yeah, it's like, okay, cool. I'm like, I like seeing that, because they tried different stuff, and it was clearly somebody being creative. So I adore the show. I really enjoy talking about it, but there's no way around it that Ultraman commits a war crime in the second episode.
But then it can only go upwards from there, right? Because that's the lowest you can get, is committing war crimes and genocide. So they're starting this off on an upward trajectory. That's what they're doing.
It's like, what? That's not okay? I mean, it's, oops. You guys have rules against that here? I am so sorry. Where I come from, we just shoot the invader. That's what we
do. Oh yeah. Maybe that's the lesson here.
Oh, it's so rough. It is rough. And then you throw in the sinister laugh that the Daltons have, and like, that could just be their voice, but it sounds like an evil super villain laugh. again, love it dearly. I got the bobblehead, so that will be featured as an image, but yeah, it's rough. It is rough. So again, talk to your kids about genocide. And you were wondering about how to talk to your children about the social wrongs of genocide. Here's a gateway of
the second episode of Ultraman.
Billy, how'd that make you feel? Why'd the spaceship blow up, Daddy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, for all the parents out there, have fun with that. So,
yeah.
Well, listen, we'll have more, and we'll get into Ultra Q, and we'll get into the animated series soon as well, because there's lots of fun there. And
and I have lots of time in life in lockdown.
Yeah, I miss barbers. I so miss barbers. And yes, yes, yes. So again, we'll be blogging, we'll be writing and recording. So everyone, stay inside. Don't go anywhere. Stay home. Flatten the curve. We'll see you all soon. Take care.